Jonas Salk, polio vaccine, and vaccinating against hate. Personal Reflections by Donald Harvey Marks. Dr. Jonas Salk was a revered physician researcher whose team discovered a vaccine to prevent the terrible disease of paralytic polio. To many at the time, he was almost a god, a savior from the horror of polio. There is much to be learned from Dr. Salk's life, his lasting effect on the terrible disease of polio, bioethics, and the impact of preventable childhood diseases on society. Polio is a disease of the nervous system caused by a virus, a non-living but very complex biochemical. Polio is often experienced as a flu-like illness. Symptoms can range from nausea, fever, diarrhea, and can progress to damaging the nerves, which cause muscles to contract, leading to its most feared component, paralysis. First recorded in 1935, polio outbreaks grew steadily more prevalent. Public health a century ago was in its infancy, and it took a long time to realize that the virus was transmitted by fecal matter and secretions of the nose and throat. Poliovirus enters the victim orally, establishes itself in the intestine, and then travels to the brain or spinal cord. I suspect that many of you have never seen a case of polio, and for those physicians listening, you may expect to go your entire career without ever treating one case. Every year in the United States, there are a handful of breakthrough cases of polio from vaccine failure and always from the live vaccine. Polio is successfully eradicated from most countries in the world and only is left in a few, such as Pakistan, where the vaccination efforts have been hindered. During the 1914 and 1919 polio epidemics in the U.S., large numbers of individuals came down with the disease and thousands died. The public, parents, teachers, and healthcare workers panicked. Physicians and nurses made house-to-house searches to identify all infected persons. Children suspected of being infected were taken to hospitals, and the child's family was quarantined until they could no longer be potentially infectious. Sometimes parents under home quarantine could not go to their own child's funeral if the child died in the hospital. Jonas Salk was born into a time of polio plague in New York City on October 28, 1914. His parents, Daniel and Dora Salk, were Ashkenazi Jews from Russian Jewish immigrant families and had not received extensive formal education. Salk grew up in the Jewish immigrant culture of New York. He had two younger brothers, Herman and Lee, who became a child psychologist. When he was 13, Jonas Salk entered Townsend Harris High School, a public school for intellectually gifted students. At that time, Ivy League schools restricted enrollment of Jews and Blacks, which Salk did not consider at that time, and as an adult seemed to have had little influence on his success. Jonas was known as a perfectionist who read everything he could lay his hands on. Students at Townsend had to cram a four-year curriculum into just 3 years. As a result, most dropped out or flunked out. Of the students who graduated, however, most would have the grades to enroll in City College of New York, noted for being a highly competitive college. As a child, Salk later said, I was not interested in science. I was merely interested in things human, the human side of nature, if you like, and I continued to be interested in that. Salk enrolled in City College at the age of 15, from which he earned a Bachelor of Science degree in 1934. For working-class immigrant families, City College represented the apex of public higher education. Getting in was tough, but tuition was free. Competition was intense, but the rules were fairly applied. No one got an advantage based on an accident of birth. At his mother's urging, Salk put aside aspirations of becoming a lawyer and instead concentrated on those classes necessary for admission to medical school. However, the facilities at City College at that time were barely second rate. There was no research lab, and the library was inadequate. The faculty contained few noted scholars. What made the place special was a diverse student body that had fought so hard to get there, driven by their parents. From these ranks, from the 1930s and 1940s, emerged a wealth of intellectual talent, including more Nobel Prize winners, 8, and PhD recipients than any other public college except the University of California at Berkeley. After college, Jonas applied to and was accepted at NYU School of Medicine. NYU based its, at that time, modest reputation on famous alumni such as Walter Reed, who helped conquer yellow fever, another devastating disease caused by a virus. Tuition was comparatively low. Better still, NYU did not discriminate against Jews and blacks. While most of the surrounding medical schools, Columbia, Cornell, University of Pennsylvania, and Yale, had rigid quotas in place against Jews and blacks, it's hard for us today to grasp what inhibiting psychological effect quotas had on young Jews and blacks who considered applying to college and professional schools. Yale Medical School, for example, accepted 76 applicants in 1935 out of a pool of 501. Although 200 of the applicants were Jewish, only 5 got in. The overall odds of admission have only gotten worse, I can assure you. During his years at NYU School of Medicine, Salk stood out from his peers for his continued academic prowess and because he had decided he did not want to practice medicine, instead becoming absorbed in research. My intention was to go to medical school and then become a medical scientist, Salk later reflected. I did not intend to practice medicine. Although in medical school and in my internship, I did all the things that were necessary to qualify me in that regard. I had opportunities along the way to drop the idea of medicine and go into science, Salk said. At one point, at the end of my first year of medical school, Salk continued, I received an opportunity to spend a year in research and teaching in biochemistry, which I did. And at the end of that year, I was told that I could, if I wished, switched and get a PhD in biochemistry. But my preference was to stay with medicine, and I believe that this is all linked to my original ambition or desire, which is to be of some help to humankind, so to speak, in a larger sense than just on a one-to-one basis. Many of us have faced the option of helping on a one-on-one basis, as Salk said, or to a larger cause in general, helping someone we know make a car payment, or giving to United Way, helping a neighbor out of work to buy food for their children, or set up an auto deduction for Feed the Children, pay for a stranger's dental bills, or send a check to a political campaign, direct and personal, or indirect, and to benefit a group or cause. These can be difficult decisions. The day after his graduation from medical school, Salk married Donna Lindsay, a master's candidate at the New York College of Social Work. Donna's father, Elmer Lindsay, a wealthy Manhattan dentist, viewed Salk as a social inferior, several cuts below Donna's former suitors. Eventually, her father agreed to the marriage on two conditions. First, Salk must wait until he could be listed as an official MD on the wedding invitations. And second, he must improve his, quote, rather pedestrian status by giving himself a middle name. I think that the attitude of all of the Lindsay family cursed the Salk marriage from the start, although the decay took years to become lethal. How many of our own relationships are tainted in a subtle but insidious manner, the stain only expressing itself years later? We act surprised, but if we look deeper, we can see the causality and the final outcome. Salk's marriage produced 3 sons, Peter, Daryl, and Jonathan Salk, but ended years later in divorce. After graduating from medical school, Salk began his residency at the prestigious Sinai Hospital in the laboratory of Dr. Francis. A friend of Saul commented, "To intern at Mount Sinai was like paying ball for the New York Yankees. Only the top men from the nation's medical schools dared apply. Out of 250 who sought the opportunity, only a dozen were chosen." The fight against polio really began in 1938 when the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis was born. That same year, the first March of Dimes fundraising program was set up, with radio networks offering free 30-second slots for promotion. Listeners were asked to send in a dime, and the White House received 2.6 million letters within days. The Francis Lab perfected a flu vaccine that was soon widely used at Army bases. Salk had been responsible for discovering and isolating one of the flu strains that was included in the final vaccine. "I have had dreams and I have had nightmares," Salk said, "but I have conquered my nightmares because of my dreams." This flu vaccine was also the origin of Salk's first controversy. Beginning around 1942, Dr. Francis and other researchers, one of whom was Salk, injected patients in an insane asylum with an experimental influenza vaccine. The group then sprayed influenza virus into the nasal cavities of these mental patients months later to check the vaccine's efficacy. It is questionable at best whether any of these patients could have adequately consented to what was being done to them or understood why. I can assure you that this would be nearly impossible to do today in the Western world. But if we judge from the context of 1942, it may seem less controversial. The 1918 flu pandemic 24 years previously was unusually deadly. 500 million people across the world were infected, and flu killed 50 to 100 million of them, 3 to 5% of the world's population, making it one of the deadliest natural disasters in human history. "Intuition will tell the thinking mind where to look next," Salk said. "It is always with excitement that I wake up in the morning wondering what my intuition will toss up to me, like gifts from the sea. I work with it and rely on it. It's my partner." In 1947, Salk received an offer for his own lab from the dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, with funding from the Mellon family. "Nothing happens quite by chance," Salk said. "It's a question of accretion of information and experience." Paralytic polio was, if not the most serious, easily the most frightening public health problem of the post-World War II era. The epidemics kept getting worse, and its victims were usually children. In the 20 states that reported the disease back in 1916, there were 27,000 cases. New York alone had 9,000 cases, of which 2,400 or 28% resulted in death and a large number in paralysis. However, polio did not gain national attention until 1921, when Franklin D. Roosevelt, former vice president candidate and soon to be governor of New York, came down with a paralytic polio. At the age of 39, Roosevelt was left with severe paralysis and spent most of his presidency in a wheelchair. As more states began recording instances of polio, the number of victims grew larger. Nearly 58,000 cases of polio were reported in 1952, with 3,100 people dying and 21,000 left with mild to disabling paralysis. In some parts of the country, concern consumed almost the dimensions of panic. Parents kept their children home from school, avoided parks and swimming pools, and played only in small groups with the closest of friends. Cases usually increased during the summer when children were home from school. As the fear of polio increased each year, funds to combat it increased from $1.8 million to $67 million by 1955. Research continued during those years, but it turned out that everything scientists believed about polio at first was wrong, leading them down many blind alleys. Furthermore, most researchers were experimenting with highly dangerous live vaccines. In one test, six children were killed and 3 left crippled. I pictured myself as a virus or a cancer cell, Salk said, and I sensed what it would be like. After successful tests on laboratory animals, an experimental vaccine had to be tested on human beings. In November 1953, at a conference in New York's Waldorf Astoria Hotel, Salk said, I will be personally responsible for the vaccine. He announced that his wife and 3 sons had been among the first volunteers to be inoculated with his vaccine. As a result of his preliminary results in 1954, when polio was destroying more American children than any other communicable disease, Salk's vaccine was ready for field testing. There is hope in dreams, imagination, and in the courage of those who wish to make those dreams a reality, Salk said. With the hope of the world upon him, Salk worked 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for years. It had been, Salk later described, 2.5 years of drudgery and hard work. The reward for work well done is the opportunity to do more, he said. I am sure he believed that, but one can only speculate on what effect this level of work had on his personal life. His first marriage ended in divorce in 1968. The field trial set up to test the Salk vaccine was the most elaborate program of its kind in history, involving 20,000 physicians and public health officers, 64,000 school personnel, and 220,000 volunteers. Over 1.8 million school children took part in the trial. When you inoculate children with the polio vaccine, you don't sleep well for 2 or 3 months, Salk said. On April 12, 1955, Dr. Francis declared the vaccine to be safe and effective. This announcement was made exactly 10 years to the day after the death of President Roosevelt. Church bells rang across the country. Factories observed moments of silence. Synagogues and churches held prayer meetings, and parents and teachers wept. Salk was hailed as a miracle worker, and the day almost became a national holiday. His sole focus had been to develop a safe and effective vaccine as rapidly as possible, with no interest in personal profit. When asked about the safety of the polio vaccine he developed, Salk said, "It is safe, and you can't get any safer than safe." Still, he also commented in reflection, "It is said to wait certainty is to wait eternity." There are 2 basic types of polio vaccine, the Salk vaccine, which is inactivated, and the Sabin live attenuated vaccine. Every year, there are a handful of polio cases in the U.S. from live attenuated polio vaccine breakthrough. Salk preferred not to have his career as a scientist affected by too much personal attention, as he had always tried to remain independent and private in his research and in his life. But this proved to be impossible. He made scientists and journalists alike go goofy. As one of the only living scientists whose face was known the world over, Salk, in the public's eye, had a superstar aura. Airline pilots would announce that he was on board, and passengers would burst into applause. Hotels routinely would upgrade him into their penthouse suites. A meal at a restaurant inevitably meant an interruption from an admirer, and scientists approached him with jaw-dropping wonder, as though some of the stardust might rub off. This was not my experience when meeting a more gentle, relaxed, and personable Salk, as I shall describe shortly. For the most part, Salk became resentful of what he considered an invasion of his privacy. The New York Times, a few months after his vaccine announcement, wrote that, at 40, the once obscure scientist was lifted from his laboratory almost to the level of a folk hero. He received a presidential citation, a score of awards, 4 honorary degrees, 6 foreign decorations, and letters from thousands of fellow citizens. His alma mater, City College of New York, gave him an honorary degree as Doctor of Law, but Despite such very nice tributes, the New York Times wrote, Salk is profoundly disturbed by the torrent of fame that has descended upon him. He talks continually about getting out of the limelight and back to his laboratory because of his genuine distaste for publicity, which he believes is inappropriate for a scientist. Salk himself said, The worst tragedy that could have befallen me was my success. I knew right away that I was through, cast out. In 1969, a year following his divorce, Salk was introduced to Francoise Gillot, a French author, artist, and former lover to Pablo Picasso. Their shared appreciation of architecture, among other things, led to a brief courtship, and they were married in 1970 in Paris and were together until Salk's death on June 23, 1995. During a 1980 interview, Salk said, It's as if I've become public property ever since, having to respond to external as well as internal impulses. It's brought me enormous gratification. Opened many opportunities, but at the same time placed many burdens on me. It altered my career, my relationships with colleagues. I am a public figure, no longer one of them, he said. We can only imagine what the full extent of personal toll on him was. Yet that is the way of men, many who are successful academically, in business, the arts, or otherwise, for academic wisdom is powerful but limited and limiting. Placing all of your hopes and dreams and efforts in only one area leaves no cushion for the inevitable failures. If Salk the scientist sounds austere, wrote the New York Times, Salk the man is a person of great warmth and tremendous enthusiasm. People who meet him generally like him. That is how I knew Jonas Salk. Award-winning geneticist Walter Nelson Rees called him a Renaissance scientist, brilliant, sophisticated, driven, a fantastic creature. I completely agree. Salk had very little perceptible interest in the things that interest most people, such as making money. That is how I found Dr. Salk in 1992. We spent about 3 wonderful hours one-on-one at a vaccine conference in Paris. As we talked, he was relaxed, responsive, pleasant, and not at all put off. I remember that only part of our discussion related to vaccines. I asked him about the practice of medicine, research as a medical career, and how he viewed the future of vaccines. I, too, had taken a mostly research path in medicine, and I enjoyed vaccine research also. We talked about his experiences as a Jew, as a Jewish doctor, and the public perception and expectations of Jewish doctors. Growing up Jewish today is a lot different from growing up Jewish in the 50s and 60s, with their restrictive country clubs, colleges, and bathrooms, and all the subtle discrimination, but can be just as dangerous in existence. In 1966, Salk described his ambitious plan for the creation of a kind of Socratic academy where the supposedly alienated two cultures of science and humanism would have a favorable atmosphere for cross-fertilization, in Salk's words. The peaceful coexistence of science and religion is very much in the spirit of modern philosophers, such as the Protestant Bishop John Spong. In the years after his discovery of the polio vaccine, many supporters, and particularly the National Foundation, helped Salk build his dream of a research complex for the investigation of biological phenomena from cell to society. The Salk Institute for Biological Studies opened in 1963. Many people who you may know of suffered from polio. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, Yitzhak Perlman, one of the greatest violinists in the world, was permanently disabled at age 4 and still plays sitting down. Actors Donald Sutherland, Alan Alda, and Lionel Barrymore. Writers Arthur C. Clarke and Robert Anton Wilson. Actress Mia Farrow. Singer-musicians Neil Young, David Sanborn, Dinah Shore, and Joni Mitchell. Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Director Francis Ford Coppola. Nuclear physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, Congressman James H. Schuller. Claudius, the Emperor, Dinah Shore, Frida Kahlo, the artist, Henry Holden, actor, comedian, athlete, and activist, Jack Nicholas, Robert Drury, the actor, Joni Mitchell and Judy Collins, Mel Ferrer, the actor, Neil Young, Shelley Mann. How then are we doing over 65 years into the availability of the polio vaccine? In 2011, there were only 650 wild polio cases. Most were in endemic countries such as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Chad. The polio eradication through vaccination has in general worked and has similar approach for other lethal viruses like smallpox. As Salk said, there are two kinds of medical specialists. There are those who fight disease day and night, who assist mankind in times of despair and agony, and who preside over the awesome events of life and death. Others work in the quiet detachment of the laboratory. Their names are often unknown to the general public, but their research may have momentous consequences. Salk was considered to be the father of biophilosophy, the application of a biological evolutionary point of view to philosophical, cultural, social, and psychological problems. As a biologist, Salk believed that science was on the frontier of tremendous new discoveries. As a philosopher, Salk thought that humanists and artists have joined the scientists to achieve an understanding of man and all his physical, mental, and spiritual complexity. Such interchanges might lead, Salk hoped, to a new and important school of thinkers. He's designated as the biophilosopher. Salk's concept of God was internally consistent with his biophilosophy. He thought of a biophilosopher as someone who draws upon the scriptures of nature, recognizing that we are the product of the process of evolution, and understands that we have become the process itself through the emergence and evolution of our consciousness, our awareness, our capacity to imagine and anticipate the future and to choose among alternatives. Salk's concepts are even more relevant today with our advances in the understanding of the brain and consciousness, the use of images to read thoughts, and the growth of the internet as a repository for human knowledge and social awareness. Switching for a moment from Salk the biophilosopher to polio, the dreaded paralytic disease, what are the major causes of death in the USA, and what meanings can we learn? Other than cardiovascular disease and cancer, the remainder of the top causes of death certainly are preventable. With respect to suicide, sadly, there are as many as 47,000 suicides per year and one suicide per day in our military. More than three women and one man are murdered by their intimate partners in this country every day. One third of women murdered each year are killed by intimate partners. Infectious diseases like polio, which can be passed from person to person, for the most part, are preventable. These include hepatitis, HIV, pneumonia, meningitis, DTP, urinary and staph infections, and coronavirus. Major infectious diseases affecting children include chickenpox and shingles, cold sores, which are herpes simplex, impetigo, measles, rubella, which is German measles, scabies, meningitis, DTP, and diarrhea. These are, for the most part, preventable through hygiene, medication, and vaccines. Worldwide, in 2010, 7.6 million children died, less than 5 years of age. About half of child deaths occur in Africa. Approximately 60 countries make up 94% of under five child deaths. According to UNICEF, most child deaths result from one of the following five causes or a combination thereof. Acute respiratory infections, diarrhea, measles, malaria, war, and malnutrition. In New Jersey in 2017, deaths in children between the ages of 1 to 4 years old were 13 per 100,000, whereas in the U.S. overall, it was 24 per 100,000. And of those deaths, 24% were unintentional, 11% were cancer, and 13% were birth defects. In New Jersey, there are over a million families with 1.9 million children in total. Low-income children, which is defined as a family of four with two children and a total income of $48,700. 32% of New Jersey children live in low-income families. So we see that infectious diseases are not among the leading causes of death for children in New Jersey or in any American state. Most causes of child death in New Jersey, in the USA, and in the world are preventable, and we know how to prevent them. In fact, no research is needed. We can act now. We have programs to reduce cancer, drowning, motor vehicle accidents, but the incidence rate per year is constant for many of these problems. Our efforts would seem not to be effective. Easily two-thirds of childhood deaths worldwide are preventable. Malnutrition and the lack of safe water and sanitation contribute to half of all these children's deaths. Research and experience shows that most of the children who die each year could be saved by low-tech, evidence-based, cost-effective measures such as vaccines, antibiotics, micronutrient supplementation, insect-treated bed nets, improved family care, and breastfeeding practices, and oral rehydration therapy. In addition to providing vaccines and antibiotics to children, education could also be provided to mothers about how they can make simple changes to living conditions, such as improved hygiene, in order to increase the health of their children. Mothers who are educated will also have increased confidence in the ability to take care of their children, thereby providing a healthier relationship and environment for them. Many societal afflictions are certainly transmissible from person to person. Hatred, violence, bigotry, murder. Once persons are infected, these diseases pass like poliovirus to infect the brain. Why not, in the tradition of Salk, create vaccines to immunize people, immunize society, immunize cultures, immunize various ethnic and religious groups against these social diseases? We have known for a long time what components are needed to go into this vaccine. Love, tolerance, education, equality, and social justice. The injection will be painless, but the vaccine's efficacy is dependent on the will of individuals, leaders, and society to react. In summary, each of us can become, in our own lives, like Dr. Jonas Salk, to dedicate our lives to the prevention of death and suffering, both on an individual level and for the greater humanity, locally and throughout the world, for our brothers and our sisters everywhere. Let us use the vaccine of peace and love to make us immune to war and hate, needless suffering, poverty, and justice.
Thank you for listening to the Existentialist podcast. I have many interesting podcasts available at this location on Spotify and on Google Podcast. The text for these podcasts and all my other writings, both non-medical and medical, are available on my blog, dhmarks.blogspot.com. Let me know your feedback. your comments, suggestions, and corrections.